I'm Charlie Turner in New York for The Wall Street Journal, and this is a special What's News Election 2018 review. The midterms are over, and it's official. We have a split Congress. On Tuesday, Democrats retook control of the House of Representatives while the Republicans strengthened their lead in the Senate. Beyond Washington, Democrats won several high-profile governor's races, many in the Midwest, but they lost their bid for governor in several other states, including Florida and Georgia. At a press conference Wednesday, President Trump minimized Republican losses, saying the GOP faced opposition from well-funded candidates, adding that those who won did so because they embraced his agenda.
Candidates who embraced our message of low taxes, low regulations, low crime, strong borders, and great judges excelled last night.
The president also expressed hope for bipartisanship between the two parties.
Hopefully we can all work together next year to continue delivering for the American people, including on economic growth, infrastructure, trade, lowering the cost of prescription drugs. These are some of the things that the Democrats do want to work on. And I really believe we'll be able to do that.
Let's talk about why the elections turned out the way they did, what a divided Congress means, and the impact that that'll have on President Trump and his agenda. Joining us from Washington is Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Gerald Seib. Jerry, first of all, didn't this election show that the country remains as divided as ever? You know, young people, suburbanites, women, they went for Democrats, while rural voters and white men went for Trump and the GOP.
Yeah, I think that is the bottom line here. It is an electorate that looked, in many ways, an awful lot like the one in 2016 that elected Donald Trump, where Hillary Clinton won the popular vote and Donald Trump won the Electoral College. That's kind of what we had here. You had a blue coalition in the suburbs and among women and young people who won a lot of marginal House seats, and that's what gave Democrats control of the House. And you had a Trump coalition that seems more solid than ever in rural areas, small towns, and some of the exurbs around the big cities that held in place, and that's why the Republicans managed to win Senate seats in places like Texas and Indiana and Tennessee. And the net result, as you said, is a split verdict. But that's what the country is. It's split right now between those two visions of politics, the kind of the blue wave coalition and the red Trump-based coalition. That's what we'll be dealing with in Washington for the next 2 years as a result.
But on the other hand, Jerry, this election didn't seem to produce the blue wave that a lot of people said might carry the Democrats to victory in both chambers.
No, that's true. And the reason that didn't happen was that some of the closest but most important, at least most politically charged races, didn't go the Democrats' way. And that means Beto O'Rourke, a Democratic congressman, did not defeat incumbent Ted Cruz in the Texas Senate race. That would have been a shocker. Democrats almost, but then in the end, didn't win a big Senate seat in Florida and the governor's race in Florida. And they almost had a kind of historic candidate, Stacey Abrams, African-American woman, win the governor's race in Georgia, but she apparently has not won that race. And so all of those races would have turned a good night for Democrats into a great night for Democrats, but they came up just short on all of those. And that's the frustration for Democrats right now. They had a good night, but not a great night. And it also means, on the other hand, for President Trump, he just needed to avoid complete disaster in this election. And that's sort of what happened. He lost control of the House to the Democrats. Everybody expected that. Didn't lose it by the same margin that some past presidents have lost seats. Barack Obama in 2010 lost a lot more House seats for his party in his first midterm after election than Donald Trump will. So the Republicans can say, well, we skirted disaster.
You mentioned some of the key races. Jerry, talk about some of the other ones that stood out to you.
You know, there were some interesting early ones on the House side that led Democrats to think that, well, we're on our way to that giant blue wave. You know, you had Jennifer Wexton defeated Barbara Comstock, a Republican incumbent in the Virginia suburbs outside Washington. And that happened very early. And that seemed to confirm the trend that a big women's vote and a bunch of very attractive women candidates for Democrats might tip the tide in a bigger way. And then you had a similar phenomenon in Florida where Donna Shalala, a former Democratic cabinet member, won a seat, an open seat that had been in Republican hands. And so those seem to be early straws in the wind. And I think that that produced a lot of hopes for the Democrats that this might be that giant blue wave that they had been hoping for, but weren't sure that they were seeing take shape. Then I think a really key indicator was the Senate race in Indiana, where Joe Donnelly, a Democratic incumbent, who looked like maybe the last Democrat, moderate Democrat, who could win a Senate seat in that blue, red state, didn't get over the top, and in fact lost fairly easily. So you had a Democratic seat go down in Trump country, and that made it appear that things were not going to be that giant blue wave, and in fact, that's what happened. But at the end of the night, you had some really important races that probably didn't get as much attention as they should have, probably will in the weeks ahead, but that were good for Democrats, and that's in the governor's races in the upper Midwest. Democrats win in Michigan and in Illinois and in Minnesota, and a real shocker in Kansas, which is one that's going to be embarrassing for the Democrats. Kris Kobach, a very Trumpian candidate in a very red state that Donald Trump carried by 21 points, loses the governor's race to a Democratic woman, and in the end, that's a race that the president was very invested in and didn't go their way at all.
And we've got to mention the Florida governor's race. Andrew Gillum lost that race. He was a progressive African-American Democrat. He was the mayor, is the mayor of Tallahassee, and he went down to defeat in the end against Ron DeSantis. And I think many people were pointing to that race and a possible victory by Gillum as being a harbinger of what the Democratic Party might look like going ahead to 2020.
That's a really good point, because that was not only a high-profile race, it was kind of a test of whether a really progressive Democratic message and a kind of new wave minority Democratic candidate could win the day in a state that is in many ways a kind of a microcosm of America. Florida's got everything. And he came very close to doing it, but didn't quite get there. And you had in Florida, a very Trumpian part of the state in the Florida panhandle went heavily for Ron DeSantis, the Republican opponent to Andrew Gillum. And that turned the tide. And, you know, you had a very blue part of the state that was very blue and a very red part of the state that was very red. And you see in that race both a picture of the country and a kind of a conundrum for Democrats. What kind of candidate can win in 2020 if Andrew Gillum didn't quite get over the top in Florida in 2018?
I'm speaking with Gerald Seib. He's the executive Washington editor of The Wall Street Journal. And you're listening to What's News from The Wall Street Journal. Jerry, what does this mean for Congress's ability to govern the next 2 years? Won't a Democratic majority in the House impede President Trump's ability to get legislation passed?
It will certainly impede the president's ability to get legislation passed. That's the sort of the opening bid. But I don't think it's quite that simple for a couple of reasons. First of all, the Democrats in the House will want to show that they will be tough on the president, but that they also are preparing to govern and to do the things that they talked about, if only to lay the groundwork for the 2020 race. So they don't want to look entirely and only oppositionist. By the same token, I think President Trump is going to have to try to find some bipartisan muscles that were missing in the first 2 years, because he frankly didn't need them, and he's made some noises in that direction already. And so I think you have a couple of areas. Infrastructure spending is one. Prescription drug prices is another, where there might actually be in the first 6 months, say, of 2019, some common ground between the president and a Democratic House. After that, it's kind of hard to see a lot of policy progress. Certainly the Trump promise made late in the campaign of pushing through another tax cut, a deeper tax cut for middle-class families, is going to have some problems. Democrats are going to say, if you want to offer a bigger tax cut to middle-class families, that's fine, but the price from our point of view is to roll back some of that corporate tax cut that you passed in the Republican Congress in 2017, and that's not going to fly. And so you're going to have basically a butting of heads. I think the biggest, the most shrill debate probably now will, as it was in the campaign, be over immigration. Democrats are not going to want to fund the Trump border wall in the many billions of dollars that he's talking about. And they're going to want to do something about Dreamers, the young immigrants who came here through no action of their own as infants and children. And the president may or may not want to do that, but there's going to be a continued fight about immigration and at a probably louder decibel level even than you saw in the first 2 years of the Trump term.
Well, is there just going to be gridlock? Will the House, led by Democrats this time, be able to stymie Mr. Trump in a lot of what he wants to do?
Yeah, and I think that's going to be particularly true on some deregulation issues and, as I said, on the desire for more tax cutting. Those things just aren't going to happen. There'll be an interesting decision that both parties will have to make about whether they're really concerned about a rising federal deficit or want to do anything about it. The easiest thing to do in Washington is simply to ignore those things. I think one of the expectations that people have that might be a little overblown is that that the Democratic House will now launch into full bore investigations of all things Trump and launch into impeachment hearings against the president. I think there will be a lot of investigations, and I think an interesting test will be that Democrats in the House, using their power as leaders of committees and their separation of powers constitutional authority, will try to force the IRS to turn over President Trump's tax returns, which, of course, and famously, he refused to make public during the presidential campaign. The president will undoubtedly resist that, and that's going to be a big fight. Conversely, I don't think Democrats are going to go toward impeachment. I don't think they have. They think they have a case. I don't think that was what this election was about. They refused, by and large, to talk about that during the campaign. So I think some of the expectations on the left that now Democrats will move immediately to try to impeach the president are overblown. And even Nancy Pelosi, who will likely be the Speaker of the new Democratic House, is already indicating that's not where we're headed.
What about divisions within the Democrats, Jerry? You just mentioned Nancy Pelosi. A lot of more progressive-leaning Democrats basically don't want her to continue as the leader.
Well, there are some progressive Democrats who don't want that, and there are a lot of moderate Democrats who said in their campaigns they didn't favor having Nancy Pelosi be the Speaker of the new Democratic House. On the other hand, there's no real obvious alternative to Nancy Pelosi, and she's trying to finesse this a bit by suggesting she would be Speaker for a while, but then sort of prepare the passage to a new, different, and younger Speaker to take her place so that she's not proposing that she be Speaker for life. We'll see how that plays out. I think the biggest thing that Nancy Pelosi has is, as I said, the lack of a clear alternative.
Republicans still control the Senate. The Democratic-led House is not going to be able to stop them at all on things such as appointing new Supreme Court judges if, you know, more judges decide to retire. That's just totally out of their control.
It is. And I think that's a really important factor. And in many ways, the most important part of the election night outcome from the Republican point of view. They not only control the Senate, they have a slightly firmer grip on the Senate. The Senate can do confirmations, and particularly judicial confirmations, without regard to what the House might think. And they will do that. And so for many Republicans, that's job number one. And it will continue to get done in exactly the same way it's been done for the last 2 years. They're also is a clear path for easier confirmation of Trump appointees, and there's going to be a lot of turnover in the administration, and there was the potential if Democrats held this, took over the Senate, to have a lot of really messy confirmation battles. Now, for example, if the president wants to fire Attorney General Jeff Sessions, which he probably will do, there is a clearer path to confirming a successor. That would not have been the case if Democrats had taken control of the Senate. So Democrats in the House can look at this process and be frustrated, but there's not much they can do about it. And that, for Republicans and the Trump White House, was always the top priority Tuesday, maintain control of the Senate. They did that, and they even added a couple of seats.
Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Gerald Seib joining us from Washington. Thanks, Jerry.
Happy to be with you.
And this has been a special edition of What's News. I'm Charlie Turner in New York for The Wall Street Journal.